Welcome back, everyone. We've got an interesting one for you all today, a legal case actually sent in by a listener about copyright law. Specifically, a court battle from way back in 1930 between two plays, AB's Irish Rose and the Coens and the Kellys. Sounds like a lot of family drama. We've got a whole stack of legal opinions and briefs to dig through here. So
yeah,
what are we really getting into here?
If this case really gets at like the core of copyright law, you know, that line between inspiration and infringement, like where's the line? It boils down to this question of whether these broad plot similarities, like, you know, feuding families, children marrying against their parents' wishes, whether that kind of stuff is actually protected by copyright.
Right, right. So before we even get into like the whole legal battle, yeah, let's just sort of like set the stage.
Sure.
Can you give us a quick overview of like what these plays are even about?
Okay. So AB's Irish Rose was written by Anne Nichols.
Yeah.
And it centers around a Jewish family and an Irish Catholic family whose children fall in love. They get married secretly.
Right.
And that causes a lot of drama, a lot of conflict because of the family's religious differences. But ultimately, it's a comedy and it ends with this heartwarming reconciliation.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the Coens and the Kellys, I'm assuming, has a similar.
Very similar. Yeah. In the Coens and the Kellys, we've also got a Jewish family and an Irish family, their rivals. Their children also fall in love and secretly get married. And this drives a wedge between the families. But the play really focuses on the economic and social differences between them instead of the religious aspect.
Interesting. So they both use like the kind of like feeding families,
the trope,
secret marriage trope.
Yeah.
But within that, yeah, they're exploring totally different conflicts.
Yeah.
So how did this even end up in court?
And Nichols, the author of Abby's Irish Rose, she felt that the Coens and the Kellys, which was produced by Universal Pictures, was a little too close for comfort.
I see.
She sued Universal Pictures for copyright infringement, believing they had basically just lifted key elements from her play.
Yeah, I can see why she would think that. On the surface, they sound very similar.
Right.
But you're saying like the core conflicts are
It becomes really important to the case. Heck.
Okay.
And this is where we get to Learned Hand.
Okay.
Who was the judge on this case. He's kind of a big deal in legal history.
Yeah, I've heard the name.
Yeah.
I know he's a big deal legally.
He's a giant. What he said in this case still has a major impact on copyright law today.
Oh, wow. Okay, so what was his take on whole thing?
Judge Hand sided with Universal Pictures.
Oh, wow.
He found that the similarities between the plays were too general to be considered copyright infringement.
Okay.
And he has this really famous quote where he says, "Nobody has ever been able to fix that boundary and nobody ever can."
What did he mean?
He was referring to that
Al-Jashir
challenge of where inspiration ends and infringement begins.
Right. So he's basically saying you can't copyright a general plot idea.
Yeah.
But you can copyright like the specific expression of that idea.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, that's a really critical distinction in copyright law. You can't copyright the concept of feuding families or secret marriage, but you can protect the specific characters, dialogue, plot details, you know, that make up your unique expression.
Right. That's a helpful way to think about it. Like, it's not about, like, owning the building blocks.
Right.
But it's about owning, like, the specific structure that you build.
That's a great analogy.
Okay.
And Judge Hand actually used a really memorable comparison to illustrate this point. He said, "A comedy based upon conflicts between Irish and Jews, into which the marriage of their children enters, is no more susceptible of copyright than the outline of Romeo and Juliet."
Okay, so he's basically saying like star-crossed lovers from feuding families.
Exactly.
That's like a classic.
It's a classic
trope that's free for anyone to use.
Yeah.
It's all about how you make it your own.
Mm-hmm.
So what does all of this mean for like creators today?
Well, this case set a powerful precedent for how copyright law is applied to creative works, particularly in theater and film.
Okay.
It highlighted that courts should focus on the unique details of a work, not just a general outline, when evaluating claims of infringement.
And that's like even more relevant now with all these like remakes and adaptations and reboots and all that stuff.
Right. How do we determine what's fair use versus infringement in our current creative landscape? That's the million-dollar question.
Yeah, and it's a question we're still grappling with, like, as technology changes and as creative mediums change.
Absolutely.
So I'm starting to see how this case is more than just like a historical legal battle. This is something that actually impacts how we create and share our work today.
Exactly. So what else stood out to you about like Judge Hand's ruling? Like what details really drive home
Yeah.
His reason. Sure. Well, one thing that really struck me was how Judge Han emphasized like the limitations of copyright protection. You know, he made it clear that copyright doesn't cover broad elements like general ideas, stock characters, or basic plot points.
Yeah.
It's about the specific way those elements are expressed.
Right. So it's not about like owning the raw materials of a story.
Yeah.
But it's about owning like the blueprint that you create from them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He argued that like protecting those broader elements would stifle creativity and it would prevent artists from building upon existing ideas and conventions. I mean, storytelling thrives on shared inspiration.
It's like we're all drawing from like this
yeah.
massive well of shared storytelling
yeah.
elements. And it's up to each creator to yeah. like use those elements in their own.
In your own unique way.
Unique way.
Yeah, Judge Hand actually used this term, public domain, to describe that common pool of ideas and expressions.
Okay.
He recognized that some elements of storytelling are just so widespread and ingrained in our culture that they belong to everyone.
Right.
They're freely available for anyone to use and adapt.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So copyright isn't just about avoiding copying from a specific work. It's also about acknowledging that, like, some elements of storytelling are just too general
right.
to be owned.
Yeah. He understood that borrowing, adapting, building upon existing ideas are, like, essential for creativity to flourish. Mm. He didn't want copyright law to become, like, a roadblock to that process.
Oh, I can definitely see how this was a landmark decision
yeah.
For
establishing those boundaries.
Those boundaries. But how do those boundaries actually play out in practice? Like,
right.
they can't always be so.
It's not always black and white.
Clear cut.
Yeah. One of the biggest challenges is figuring out where to draw the line between an unprotectable idea and its protectable expression.
Right.
It often comes down to like a case-by-case analysis,
yeah.
looking at the specific works in question.
So you have to look at the individual details of
yeah.
each work
yeah.
and compare how those details contribute
exactly.
to the overall impression.
There's a legal term for this concept, the idea-expression dichotomy.
Yeah.
Basically means an idea itself can't be copyrighted, but the unique creative choices you make in expressing that idea are what make your work original and worthy of protection.
Can you give me an example of how that principle might apply to something a little more modern?
Absolutely. Let's say two authors both write novels about a group of teenagers who discover they have superpowers.
Okay.
The basic idea is the same, but the way they express that idea through characters, plot writing, style, and so on could be drastically different. One novel might be like a dark dystopian thriller, while the other is like a lighthearted coming-of-age adventure.
Right.
Even though they share a similar premise, they could both be considered original works under copyright law because their specific expressions of that idea are distinct.
So it's not about having a completely unique idea.
Yeah.
It's about expressing that idea
right.
in a way that's uniquely your own.
Precisely. It's like those draw this again challenges where artists reinterpret the same basic image in their own style.
Oh, yeah.
Copyright law recognizes that ideas themselves aren't protectable, but the creative choices you make in expressing those ideas are what set your work apart.
It makes you think about all the books and movies and songs that share similar ideas.
Yeah.
But what makes them stand out are like those individual creative choices.
Exactly. Like even within a specific genre, like romantic comedies, most of them follow the same basic formula.
Right.
But we remember them for those unique details.
That's a great way to think about it.
Mm.
But judging from all the copyright lawsuits
yeah.
we hear about, applying this idea expression dichotomy can't always be easy.
It definitely can get tricky. And as technology and creative mediums evolve, those boundaries become even more blurred.
Right.
Think about the rise of digital sampling in music.
Yeah.
How much of an existing song can you sample before it crosses the line from inspiration to infringement?
That's a good point, right? Like every new technology creates new challenges for copyright law
yeah.
to grapple with.
It's a constant balancing act.
Right.
We have to protect creators' rights while also allowing room for creative freedom and inspiration.
It sounds like Judge Hand's ruling in this case really established like an important foundation.
It did.
For how we navigate those complex questions.
Absolutely.
Even almost 100 years later.
Mm.
It makes you wonder what he would think about
I know
all the ways we create and share content today.
Absolutely. It's a testament to how those fundamental questions about creativity, inspiration, and ownership are timeless. But he also recognized the importance of not getting too bogged down in technicalities when making those judgments.
What do you mean?
Well, in his ruling, Judge Hand was critical of using expert witnesses to dissect and compare the two plays scene by scene. He felt like their analysis was ultimately unhelpful and even confusing.
Oh.
He believed that judges should rely on their own overall impression of the works rather than getting lost in the weeds of overly technical comparisons.
So he was advocating for a more intuitive,
yeah,
holistic approach.
Exactly. He felt that capturing the essence of a creative work and determining if it truly infringes on someone else's copyright requires stepping back and looking at the bigger picture.
That's a really interesting perspective.
Mm.
It makes you wonder how that approach would be applied to modern mediums,
mm-hmm,
like video games or internet memes,
right,
where the line between inspiration and copying can get even blurrier.
You've hit on a crucial point. This case, though, dealing with plays from nearly a century ago, raises questions that are still relevant today.
Yeah.
It reminds us that copyright law is a constantly evolving conversation about how we value and protect creativity in a world that's always changing.
It's incredible how much insight we can glean from a single case about two seemingly similar plays.
Mm-hmm.
We explored the idea-expression dichotomy, mm-hmm, the public domain, and even the importance of taking a holistic view of a work's artistic intent.
Yeah.
And we haven't even touched on the fact that copyright protection doesn't last forever.
That's right. Eventually, creative works enter the public domain, becoming part of our shared cultural heritage. But before we get into that, I wanted to highlight one more aspect of Judge Hand's ruling that really stood out to me. He went beyond simply comparing plot points and characters and considered the overall tone and message of each play.
Oh, that's interesting. What do you have to say about that?
Well, he noted that AB's Irish Rose, you know, while comedic, is ultimately a story about reconciliation and overcoming prejudice.
Okay.
The Coens and the Kellys, on the other hand, relies more heavily on slapstick humor and social satire.
So he was looking beyond just the surface similarities and considering, like, the deeper thematic,
yeah,
intentions.
Exactly. He recognized that even when two works share some plot or character elements, they can be vastly different in terms of their overall artistic goals and impact.
Right.
And those differences can be crucial when deciding whether copyright infringement has actually occurred.
So it sounds like he was saying it's not just about, like, the individual parts of a story.
Yeah.
But how those parts work together to create a unique whole.
Precisely. And that holistic perspective is something that's often overlooked in discussions about copyright.
Mm-hmm.
But as you mentioned earlier, copyright protection doesn't last forever.
Right.
Eventually, works enter the public domain, becoming free for anyone to use and adapt.
That makes sense. I mean, it wouldn't be very fair if someone could just control a creative work,
right,
indefinitely. Mm-hmm. So how does that work? Is it just a matter of time?
In most cases, yes. Here in the United States, copyright generally lasts for the lifetime of the author plus 70 years.
Okay.
For works created by corporations, the term can vary, but it's usually 95 years from publication or 120 years from creation, whichever is shorter.
Right.
Once that term is up, the work enters the public domain.
So both of these plays, AB's Irish Rose and the Coens and the Kellys, would be in the public domain now.
Absolutely. Both plays were published back in the 1920s. So their copyright protection has long since expired. Anyone could stage a production of either a play, adapt them for film or TV, or even borrow elements for new creative works without needing permission or paying royalties.
That's incredible. So it really highlights how the public domain ensures that creative works eventually become like a part of our shared,
exactly,
cultural heritage,
mm-hmm,
available for anyone to reinterpret and reimagine. It makes you wonder how those plays might be reinterpreted by artists today.
It's exciting to think about, isn't it? Imagine a modern-day adaptation of AB's Irish Rose that explores interfaith relationships in the context of today's social and political climate.
Hmm.
Or a satirical take on the Coens and the Kellys that examines class and identity in the 21st century. The possibilities are endless.
I love that. So it really shows how the public domain keeps those creative sparks flying, allowing these stories to be adapted and reshaped to reflect the changing times.
Exactly. It's a testament to the power of storytelling and how those stories can transcend their original context to connect with new audiences.
And this case that we've been deep diving into, you know, it played a crucial role in shaping how we define those boundaries,
mm-hmm,
between inspiration and infringement,
right,
ensuring that creative works eventually make their way into that shared pool of inspiration.
Right. It's amazing how a seemingly simple dispute over two plays with similar premises can have such a lasting impact on how we think about creativity ownership and the evolution of our shared cultural landscape.
It's a great reminder that sometimes the most fascinating legal battles are the ones that wrestle with those big questions about where ideas come from and how we as a society choose to protect and share them.
I couldn't agree more. It's a conversation that will likely continue for as long as humans create.
Well, as we wrap up our deep dive into this pivotal case, what's the key takeaway you want our listener to walk away with? What should they be thinking about?
If there's one thing to remember, it's that copyright law is all about finding the right balance. It's meant to protect the rights of creators, but it also needs to allow for creative freedom and the ability to be inspired by the work that came before. This case highlights that tension beautifully.
It's not about drawing like hard lines in the sand.
Right.
But it's about fostering a creative ecosystem that encourages both originality and inspiration.
Exactly. It's a nuanced and constantly evolving conversation. And I hope this deep dive encourages everyone to think critically about where their own creative ideas come from, how they build upon the work of others, and how they can contribute to that ongoing conversation about creativity and copyright.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for guiding us through this complex legal landscape.
My pleasure. I always enjoy exploring these intersections between creativity and the law.
And a big thank you to you, our listener, for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you found it insightful and thought-provoking. Remember, the next time you encounter a familiar plot or character, take a moment to consider its creative lineage. What inspired it? How has it been reinterpreted over time? And how might you contribute to its ongoing evolution? Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep creating.